This is the State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. In 1963, North Carolina Governor Terry Sanford launched one of the most innovative anti-poverty campaigns of the 1960s. It was called the North Carolina Fund, and the funding came from private foundations and in part from the Federal Office of Economic Opportunity. From Craven County in the east to Macon County in the mountains, the North Carolina Fund provided money to community organizations and initiatives. Volunteers and workers who went into the field helped communities there to try to come up with ways to address the conditions of poverty. But just a few years into the North Carolina Fund initiative, it ran into a backlash as some politicians took issue with it. The North Carolina Fund, they said, was not just delivering services to the poor, it was helping the poor gain financial stability and make political footholds. In 1968, after 5 years, the North Carolina Fund was discontinued. This hour, as we continue our series, North Carolina Voices, Understanding Poverty, we're going to take a closer look at those days in the 60s and the North Carolina Fund, and very importantly, what it taught us about how best to fight poverty here. We are joined in the studio by Jim Liloudis, who is a professor of history at UNC Chapel Hill. He has studied the war on poverty in the South and has focused on the North Carolina Fund and has written about it. Thanks for being with us today, Jim.
Thanks, Melinda. It's good to be with you.
And we welcome your calls this hour. Were you affected by the North Carolina Fund in the 60s? Did you work for an organization that was part of it, or was your community visited by volunteers from the North Carolina Fund? Our number is 1-877-962-9862. That's 1-877-962-9862. Well, Jim Liloudis, I think we ought to start from the very beginning. What exactly was the North Carolina Fund?
Well, the North Carolina Fund, as you said, was established in 1963. Today, we'd call it an NGO, non-governmental organization. It was a very innovative, one-of-a-kind anti-poverty agency, nothing like it in any other state in the country. And it served fundamentally as a kind of laboratory in which policymakers, volunteers, community leaders could experiment with ways that the poor might be involved in relieving their own condition. I think George Esser probably put it best. George was the executive director. He said that the North Carolina Fund's purpose was to create the possible.
It was at the very beginning, it had a number of volunteers who were college students who in the summers would go to some communities.
That's right. Its first program was the North Carolina Volunteers, and those volunteers worked for 2 summers of 64 and 65, 100 in the first summer, 250 in the next. Student volunteers, men and women, black and white, from every college campus in the state. Which in itself was remarkable if you think about the context of the mid-1960s, to be putting co-ed volunteer teams, interracial teams, out in communities across North
Carolina.
Because
segregation was still very strong here.
It was very strong, and this was particularly an issue in the East.
Mm-hmm. Now, the fund was started in 1963 to address poverty in the state, and this was before President Johnson launched his national war on poverty. What was it that made Governor Terry Sanford decide that he wanted to do this here, in North Carolina in particular?
Well, I point to a couple of things. First is surely the experience of World War II. Sanford and his generation went off to war. They fought alongside African-American soldiers. They also saw in Europe and in the Pacific the dreadful, brutal consequences of political ideologies, social systems built on a sense of ethnic and racial superiority. So they came home with a very deep sense that the South had to change, that it simply couldn't continue as it had always been. And of course, that was a sense that was shared by African Americans in North Carolina and across the South.
Because they were fighting in World War II.
That's right. And they had been involved in what the NAACP called the Double V campaign, that is, victory against fascism in Europe and the Pacific victory against racism here at home. There was also a building economic crisis in North Carolina. Agriculture was being mechanized. Tens of thousands of people were being turned off the land. Again, World War II had been a technological war, been a war of science and research. And anyone able to sort of look over the horizon could see that America's future prosperity rested in what we'd call a knowledge economy today. Again, Sanford understood that North Carolina simply could never compete in that new economy if it continued to have a population that was undereducated, ill health, and poor. And probably most of all, he was worried about a population, about a society, as he said in Look magazine in 1963, ridden with hate and prejudice, that these would be barriers to development.
Now, when Terry Sanford pitched the idea of the North Carolina Fund, which didn't get state money, as I understand it, but it got federal money, and also $7 million from the Ford Foundation. Largely, this was private grants. Did he pitch it as something that was going to address the race issue, or was that something he had to be careful as a politician in the early 60s in North Carolina about addressing? I'm wondering, did he emphasize, well, we're going to do something about education and something about income and poverty?
It was something he had to finesse, and Sanford had done that throughout his political career. He had been involved in the 1950 Senate campaign with Frank Porter Graham, in which race had been a powerful issue, and he understood that that issue was it was the third rail of Southern politics. He had provided leadership. He sent his own children to an integrated school in Raleigh. He certainly talked about race, but he put an emphasis on education and on the broader benefit to the state at large.
Mm-hmm. Now, so he sets this up, this North Carolina Fund, in 1963, which we should point out is going into his last year in office as governor.
That's right.
And you could only serve one term in North Carolina at that point. And so one of the facets of this is that he gets a couple hundred volunteers, college students, who go out to the communities. So the point of it was to alleviate poverty. Were these volunteers in any way going out and doing physical work to improve the conditions? What exactly did they do when these college students arrived in, you know, say, urban centers such as Durham or more rural communities that were very poor?
Well, that's right. A lot of the focus, as we said earlier, was primarily education, and that was a big issue in North Carolina. If you looked at North Carolina in 1960, about 50% of all high school students dropped out before getting a degree. Nearly a quarter of adults over 25 had no more than a sixth grade education. So the focus initially was on education. The volunteers initially are in the field doing primarily tutoring projects and recreation projects. And there was this sense that what's interesting is to go back and go into the archives here in Chapel Hill and read the letters from those students. And this remarkably idealistic sense that they just simply had to go out this summer, address those inadequacies of the poor, and poverty would be alleviated. Teach people to read, help them get a GED, sports programs for young people. But over the course of the summers, and especially in the next summer, they become also involved in improving housing, improving sanitation, and they begin to be involved, as you already suggested, some in political organizing because the volunteers themselves are changed by the experience.
And they're then encouraging those people who live in those communities themselves. And we should say, in many of those communities, these would be African Americans. And this is the early 60s, and folks are still a little wary of pressing their power.
This is volatile stuff.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to watch these students change. Again, they'd go in the field, and we have their daily diaries in the archives, and you can watch the experience unfold. And one of the things I think is fascinating is these young men and women go in, they feel that they are very liberal and open-minded, particularly on the issue of race, and then they find themselves tested when they have to put those ideals into practice. One young woman, I think, summed it up best. She said that by the time the summer was over, the burden of my poverty had been lifted. That is, she had learned about fundamental human commonalities across the race line.
So in your assessment, did the North Carolina Fund make much headway on that race issue?
It made some and not enough. Certainly, you can see individual people's lives change. The fund became very important, particularly after 1966, in providing both resources and the means for African-American communities to organize, to field voter registration campaigns, to become more involved in politics. At the same time, I think you can say that one of the things that the North Carolina Fund in the end could not overcome was the deep embedded power of race as a fundamental dividing line in North Carolina politics. And this is something that goes back very, very far in this state's history. On the one hand, this state has a fascinating history of biracial politics. During Reconstruction, more whites than in any other southern state crossed the race line and joined a biracial Republican alliance. In the 1890s, the same sort of thing happens. In both instances, they are defeated by a white supremacist campaign, which is interested in affirming the centrality of race as opposed to class as the fundamental organizing principle of this society.
Well, playing the race card because it plays more than the class card.
That's right. And, well, it was an understanding that if you had a biracial alliance, you were going to have one kind of politics. If you had a society organized around a race rather than economic, shared economic concerns, you got a different kind of politics. And one of the ways that, frankly, an economy of cheap labor was sustained in North Carolina throughout the early 20th century was through that, in effect, divide-and-conquer strategy that prevented working-class whites and African-Americans from coming together in a political alliance. And still today, I think you can see the ways that that's around us in a political discourse that suggests that we think about anti-poverty efforts as a kind of zero-sum game. That is, that if African-Americans gain, whites lose.
We are talking with history professor Jim Laloudis from UNC about the North Carolina Fund, which had a five-year run in North Carolina in the mid-1960s. It was one of the very first anti-poverty campaigns in any state and became a model for Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty at the federal level. We'll have more of our conversation with Jim Laloudis and talk with a couple of people who took part in the North Carolina Fund. And we welcome your calls. Our number's 1-877-962-9862. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava, and we are talking today about North Carolina's own war on poverty. It was called the North Carolina Fund. It began in 1963 when Governor Terry Sanford introduced it to the state. It ran for about 5 years, and we're talking about the legacy of that fund. We're taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862 if you'd like to join the conversation. With us is UNC Chapel Hill history professor Jim Laloudis, who has written about the North Carolina Fund. And right now we're joined by Shirley Hise, who is Executive Director of Economic Development and the Chamber of Commerce for Mitchell County, and Joyce Clayton, who is Director of Upward Bound at UNC Chapel Hill, an education program that targets low-income high school students. Welcome, Shirley Hise and Joyce Clayton.
Greetings from the mountains.
Greetings. And we should say we have you here because you took part in the North Carolina Fund 40 years ago. I'd like to start with you first, Joyce. You grew up in the country?
Yes, I grew up in rural Durham County in Mangum Township, which is between Rougemont and Bahama, North Carolina. And I grew up on a farm, sharecropping. My daddy was a tobacco farmer, so I worked in the fields, and it seemed sun up to sundown.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about, you were how old when the North Carolina Fund came into being, and you took part in this? What did you do?
I was a college student. I was a sophomore in college at North Carolina College at Durham, now North Carolina Central University. So in the summer of 67-68, I participated as a community organizer, and prior to that, Operation Breakthrough, as a community organizer. I also worked in Wilson, North Carolina, especially the summer of 1968.
Yeah. Now, what as a community organizer, what did you do?
As a community organizer, the primary responsibility was to go to a community and help that community help itself through helping it know what was available to it as citizens in that particular community. It was helping them by finding out what it was they felt they needed to make their lives better. It was helping them learn to read and to write, to express their views to all constituencies, and to help them with health and education issues. and making sure that we were trying to help improve the quality of their lives and help them receive all the rights and privileges they were entitled to as citizens.
Now, when you talk about making themselves heard to various constituencies, we're talking here about realizing they could have some political power,
realizing
at least using
that
the
power,
system.
Yeah. That their power was their voice. And that's what democracy is all about.
Mm-hmm. Now, what
and
kind of, did you run into resistance?
Yeah.
Did you run into resistance with that? Because we have heard tell that, you know, during the mid-60s, the civil rights era was still roiling, and there were those who were in power who maybe didn't like these upstarts and activists coming to communities.
Well, I think you get resistance on a number of, certainly the power structure and those who have vested interests in keeping it the way it is always resist. So you had that from City Hall to other areas of the community. But you also found that there were people even within the community that you were trying to help that were either afraid or also some were afraid to speak up.
Right. Well, Joyce Clayton, stay on the line for a moment, please. I want to talk now to Shirley Hise. You grew up in the other part of the state, Southern Appalachia, in Mitchell County, and you worked for the North Carolina Fund as a teenager and a college student. And your own, those people in your own community grew up poor. You did yourself. You were the target of the work for the North Carolina Fund.
That is correct. I worked as a high school student with Head Start. In the summertime, I was like a teacher assistant. And then as a college student, I worked on a program called PACE, which is under the Great Society program. And I worked with the health department setting up health clinics. They had brought teams of physicians in here to work with the county, and I worked as a liaison between the community and the health care facilities.
Yeah. Now, how was the North Carolina Fund received when it came to Mitchell County? You had these outsiders coming in.
Well, one of the areas of great concern was it kind of bypassed local politicians. The one fund was administered by WAMI Community Action, which was out of Boone, North Carolina.
And we should say WAMI stands for the four counties there, right?
Watauga, Avery, Mitchell, and Yancey.
Okay.
And so they did not have any say or input or anything like that, and it was organizations within their counties that they had no control over. And so there was a lot of controversy about that. Mm-hmm. Anytime you work on the poverty issue, you're bringing people to a level of power that they have not had before, something the things that Joyce was just talking about. And when you do that, you're going to have a lot of controversy because then other people are going to have to share power, if it's voting or whatever it turns out to be. And so attacking the issue of poverty is a very complex and complicated issue. Because you're moving people in different social levels. And if it's local politicians or the church or the community or whatever, it gets to be very complex, I think.
So did WAMI, did it work? Did it succeed?
To some degree, I think we see the impact of WAMI Community Action in terms of health clinics being in Mitchell County that would have never been available before. I think students do perform in school with the help of Head Start. I think we have transportation vans and things like here now where people can ride back and forth to clinics that we would have never had had it not been for WAMI. Mm-hmm.
Well, question for you both, Shirley Hise and Joyce Clayton. Would something like the North Carolina Fund work today if it went to those communities, to Durham in your case, Joyce, or to Mitchell County? Or was that at a certain place in time, the North Carolina Fund?
I think because poverty still exists, that the types of programs are certainly not outdated. A program that will give help, a program that will help you get an education, that will help you get better health care and improve the quality of your life, it is needed. And I think today it would be just as relevant.
Mm-hmm. Shirley Hise?
Well, again, I think the issue of poverty is very complex. Senator Edwards was in Asheville over the weekend, and the local paper had interviewed him and asked him, you know, he's working on the poverty issue through Chapel Hill, and asked him about did he plan to run for president, and his response was, well, I'm working on the poverty issue, and I want to see where that's going to take me, and I was really appalled by that and his lack of understanding of poverty, and I think that's a problem in getting people to understand what poverty is. We want Senator Edwards to take poverty to a different level rather than where it will take him. And poverty in Mitchell County, yes, we have 10.1 unemployment rate. We have 68% of our students graduating from high school, therefore creating another level of poverty. We need programs, but we need programs that work.
We are talking today about the North Carolina Fund, which between 1963 and 1968-69 was an effort in North Carolina to alleviate poverty. It operated for a while with volunteers from colleges who went into a number of the poorer communities in North Carolina, both urban and rural. We're talking with Joyce Clayton, who grew up in Durham, who was a volunteer with the North Carolina Fund, and Shirley Hies, who was also a volunteer in Mitchell County. Jim Lee Lutis is with us. He is a history professor at UNC Chapel Hill. And Jim, and I'd also like to get your opinion on this too, Shirley and Joyce. Jim, you talked a moment ago about how this was a breakthrough in the early 60s because you had not only men and women going out co-ed, but also biracial or interracial teams going into communities. And that was something big in the early 60s in North Carolina, blacks and whites working together as equals there. But you've also written that in some communities, the North Carolina Fund had more of an impact, and more so in the black communities, because in white communities, you've written, a lot of the poorer whites did not necessarily want this level playing field with the blacks in their community.
I think that's right, and WAMI may be the exception there in western North Carolina, where the African-American population was smaller, and so this issue didn't play with quite the same political force. But as these volunteers went into communities, they began to meet the resistance that Shirley and Joyce were talking about. They began to understand that poverty was not something inherent in the poor, but was a matter of politics and economics. And so you watch them begin to hunker down in those communities, particularly in African-American communities, and become involved in community organizing, whether that is helping people mobilize for federal money for something like Head Start, or it's helping to organize a voting rights campaign so that poor people might have a political voice. That is a lot harder to carry off in white communities, particularly in the Piedmont and the East, where, again, the racial issue played with such force. I mean, I think we have to remember there was a way in which welfare from the beginning had a color in many North Carolinians' minds, and that color was black. Now, of course, that's not the factual reality, but that was the perception. There was this sense, I think, among many working-class whites that the war on poverty was tied up with the civil rights movement. It was tied up with a challenge to the racial order that assured them no matter how low their status in the social system might be, African Americans were always below them. And that probably was the, to my mind, the single most difficult challenge for the North Carolina Fund, and I think one might argue for any war on poverty efforts in our own time.
Mm-hmm. Well, Shirley Hies, you grew up white in the mountains of North Carolina, and Jim was saying that the mountain area may have been the exception to this resistance among whites to the North Carolina Fund, perhaps owing to the fact that there's a far smaller percentage of the population that's African American there. Does that assessment make sense to you?
His assessment is correct, but I would go on to add that WAMI Community Action allowed for the first time women to be in leadership roles, the workers that would go out in the community, the head of the Head Start program, the head of the Neighborhood Youth Corps program turned out to be women. And I think the One Fund did provide an opportunity for women to be in leadership roles, and that was kind of a first for this area, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, Joyce Clayton, you grew up African-American in Durham. Did you find that resistance to the North Carolina Fund among whites in Durham that Jim is talking about?
I would agree with Jim that the attitude, racism, in some ways kept individuals who really, really needed the services from fully participating. When we went out as a team that was very diverse, we went out as an example of what could happen. And I think in some settings and in a lot of settings, that was very threatening to have blacks and whites working together, seemingly getting along very good. Even that idea alone challenged the authority. But the part of it for us was, as a team, we began to break down some of our own stereotypes. So going back out into communities and helping other people try to break down those kind of stereotypical attitudes and beliefs. Yes, we met it. We met it head on, and we were more successful in the African-American communities.
I wonder, strategically and tactically speaking here, not necessarily ethically speaking, but strategically speaking, might it have been a lot to bite off at once with segregation so much in force to send blacks into white communities, whites into black communities, or not? Well, if your point was to alleviate poverty, first of all, and
It was a lot to bite off, but I think there was no other way around it, because one has to understand that historically poverty and Jim Crow segregation have gone hand in hand in the history of this state. Throughout the late 19th and into the early 20th century, this state's economy was built on cheap labor. And cheap labor was sustained by a system of Jim Crow that kept working people, black and white in North Carolina, divided one against the other. So as difficult as it might have been, I think anyone who was realistic understood that you simply could not attack one problem without the other.
Mm-hmm. But you have written about the resistance that was there, and we heard a clip of tape earlier this hour from then-Congressman Jim Gardner, who was in Congress at the time and was calling out against the North Carolina Fund for those people who were part of it and targeted by it for becoming an effective political force.
Right, and it was becoming a political force. Others talked about the North Carolina Fund sponsoring what they called guerrilla warfare. There were references, of course, to outside agitators. That was always the way that change was described in the South. Our poor people wouldn't do this. Someone must have put them up to it. But I think, as Shirley and Joyce made clear earlier, what the North Carolina Fund at the end of the day, what any anti-poverty effort at the end of the day had to be about, was changing the structure of political and economic power and privilege. Mm-hmm. And that is probably the deepest, most fundamental challenge one can pose.
Mm-hmm. Shirley Hayes, did the North Carolina Fund affect the way you looked at poverty, or have your views about how to alleviate poverty, have they evolved since your work 4 decades ago with the North Carolina Fund? My question being, what's the best way to address poverty?
Well, I'm a retired high school history teacher that has gone into economic development in the Chamber of Commerce. And I see the way out of poverty is through education, and I think it has to be through a quality education. And I think with rural areas, we lack the adequate facilities to provide a quality education for our students in terms of computers, access to the outside, and things like that. I think if people in Mitchell County grow out of poverty, I think they will, part of it and will be that we improve our educational system. Mm-hmm. And in the 60s, I saw my way out of poverty through education. And that's the reason I went on to school, in part, to get out of poverty, was to get a college education and go on farther than that.
Mm-hmm. Joyce Clayton?
The fund affected me profoundly. And if we're looking at how to get out of poverty, I agree with Shirley that education is a means and a way. It enables people to direct their own choices and to be masters of their own destiny. And that is the way. That's what I was taught as a child in poverty, that a way out of it was to get educated. And I was assisted by a federal program, the National Defense Student Loan, that helped me because my parents had no money for education. The other thing is helping people believe in themselves and to know that they can make a difference, that you do not need to sit back. You must be an activist and voice your concerns. But education is the key.
40 years on, are people who are in poverty not getting that message? Does that need to be reinforced from time to time, continually?
I think that it needs to be continually voiced louder, because there are still children that are not getting equal access, for example, to higher education. When we look at federal funding for it and we're looking at low-income students, we're still talking about only 10% of them that are eligible receiving services to help them enter the doors of higher education institutions.
And we should say that you are director of Upward Bound, and that's a federally funded organization that's designed to do that, to help low-income high school students go to get their college
and
degree.
So there, yes, it is not loud enough. There is not enough funds for it, and there are not enough advocates.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think if you look at the definition of poverty, one of the things that it says is a lack of resources. And certainly in rural Western North Carolina, you know, we sometimes have to say to the people down in Raleigh, hey, there is a western part of the state here, and we have about 26 counties here economically that really lack resources in order to provide a quality education for the students and the children here.
Mm-hmm.
And so we lack the resources in Mitchell County and Yancey County and Avery County and Madison County, and all those counties lack the resources.
And are you trying to, and I wonder if your work now, Shirley Hies, you were involved in education as a teacher for years, but now working with economic development in Mitchell County, is the idea to bring the businesses there so that you have the resources?
And to improve the schools as well. We have started a program with the Chamber called Mission of a Lifetime,
mm-hmm.
where we encourage students to stay in school by using the business community here to do that.
Okay. Well, Shirley Hies, I'd like to thank you so much for being with us today. And Joyce Clayton, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Shirley Hies and Joyce Clayton were both volunteers and workers with the North Carolina Fund in the 60s. Joyce Clayton is director of Upward Bound at UNC Chapel Hill. Shirley Hies is director of the Chamber of Commerce's Economic Development Division in Mitchell County. Just ahead, we will get to more of your calls, 1-877-962-9862. We are talking about the North Carolina Fund on the State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava, and we are talking this hour about the North Carolina Fund in the 1960s. This was a five-year experiment to alleviate poverty in North Carolina, and it was a forerunner, in some ways a model, for what became then-President Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty. Jim Liloutis is with us. He's a professor of history at UNC Chapel Hill and has written about the North Carolina Fund. And joining us now is David Dotson, who is the president of MDC. This is an organization based in Chapel Hill. It is one of two remaining institutions that got their start with the North Carolina Fund, and David Dodson has been with the organization for the past 17 years, and he's here in the studio. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much.
Well, MDC stood, we should say, at one point for Manpower Development Corporation. What exactly does it do?
Well, in the days it was founded, and we still do this, MDC was created to do a couple of things. To help North Carolina make the transition from a segregated to an integrated workforce, to help the economy make the transition from an agricultural to an industrial economy, and as our founder said, to help the society, and particularly its workers, learn how to no longer work by the sun, but learn to work by the clock. So it was an attempt to accelerate and ameliorate the natural transition from an agricultural way of life as the basis of our economy to an industrial one, and to make sure disadvantaged people were integrated into economic opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Now, going from agricultural to industrial, this would have been in the 1960s.
Yes.
Today we've seen so many of those industrial jobs, the manufacturing jobs in North Carolina, evaporate. I mean, by the tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands.
Exactly.
So what now?
Now it's from the industrial to the knowledge-based service economy. That values the kind of education that we've been talking about, our guests have been talking about earlier. And that's just as wrenching and difficult a transition. And it's creating, I think importantly, as much dislocation, social distress, and disconnection from opportunity as the previous transition did. So in a sense, many of the need to help people make a transition from a vulnerable situation to a more secure economic situation remains work that we have to do today in North Carolina, around the South, and around the country.
So your organization publishes the State of the South report every 2 years. What trends are you seeing with poverty in the region and in North Carolina in particular?
Well, you know, the big issue is that poverty is the inability to earn, build assets, and create the pathways to a middle-class life. And the best predictor of a person's ability to earn is the ability to gain an educational foothold, educational attainment. So finishing high school and going to something beyond, whether it be a community college degree or a BA, is an absolute precondition for being able to be on that path for a middle-class existence. And what we know now is that far too many people, and particularly people of color, are inadequately educated in the society we have today. There also is a significant rural-urban divide. So poverty and the inability to make the transition to the new economy has to do with people, and it has to do with place. Mm-hmm.
And I should say that in our series about understanding poverty, we will be talking about that rural-urban divide. But it sounds in a way like you may have boiled down poverty, the idea of poverty, to investment. That is to say, investing in an education. It needn't be a master's degree, but finishing high school, investing the time in that, and something beyond.
I think this is simplistic, but education sets one up to work and earn at higher levels. And working and earning at higher levels allows a person or a family to build assets. And assets provide the intergenerational foundation to be able to continue on that path to prosperity. So education plus earnings plus assets seem, to us at least at MDC, to be a basic formula to help people exit poverty and move into a more secure situation, a middle-class situation.
Mm-hmm. But what about somebody who is not, say, 17 years old and has to make that choice between finishing high school, but somebody who might be 17, has two kids, and can't possibly do that? I mean, what do you do in that case?
Well, I think...
Or somebody who's 23 and has three kids and has to work two jobs.
I think we have to recognize that there are such folks out there. And in fact, there need to be deep social supports to help people get back on the pathways to exercise that formula that we know works. That's why community colleges, if we talk about infrastructure, the infrastructure of opportunity, the community college system that we have in North Carolina is perhaps, I think, the most critical one for helping all people, the young person who's dropped out, the adult who has to reskill, get back on that pathway to opportunity. That plus community and social supports have to be things that are in place. We're very lucky in North Carolina. We're very lucky in that we have a pervasive community college infrastructure that's in the mountains as well as in the Piedmont as well as in at the coast. And that gives us an enormous foundation for doing what's necessary. So absolutely, yes. We've got to make sure that every person, the economy today demands it, that every person have the chance to get educated to the level where they can make a contribution.
Jim Laloudis, this almost gets what David Dodson is saying. It gets back to what Terry Sanford was emphasizing at the get-go with the North Carolina Fund, which was education.
Well, I was about to say, as a historian, it's very interesting to listen to David, because I'm sitting here thinking this is a wonderful example of how we, in a way, have to rediscover something that a generation before understood so well. If you look at the time frame, okay, we talk about a knowledge economy, education, so the role of the community college system, the Research Triangle Park, the North Carolina Fund, and the North Carolina Community College System were all launched within a 5-year window. That generation before us understood so well the ways in which those things were connected. This is a place, I think, where we could stand to go back and recover some of that understanding. We're not served well by having forgotten this period.
You know, and I think, if I may, one of the reasons North Carolina has done so well relative to other southern states is that we did make those investments early on, and we capitalized on them. We had the courage to extend them across the divisions of race in ways that other states didn't, and that allowed us to move ahead. Now we've got to figure out what that foundation is for the next generation.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, though, and this brings us, maybe this is more a philosophical question about defining poverty, which we tried to do yesterday on the program. You mentioned RTP being born then in the 60s, and that has brought a lot of technological jobs and arguably has raised the income level of those type of places, those research development places. Technologically based, not just in the Triangle area, but elsewhere in North Carolina, has raised perhaps the average income here, but we're still dealing with people who don't have as much. And Jim Lalutis, you wrote in your writings about the North Carolina Fund that some of the same things that Terry Sanford was trying to address 40 years ago are with us today. One of them is income gap.
Well, that's right. And David's already emphasized this, the importance of education. There, some recent statistics actually suggest that the difference between a college degree and a high school diploma is a doubling of lifetime earnings. And our challenge now is also this rural-urban divide. We're in a way two North Carolinas, an urban I-85 Piedmont corridor, North Carolina, that's doing pretty well compared to the rest of the country, another rural North Carolina that increasingly has been left behind. And this is, again, where I think we might take a lesson from the North Carolina Fund. One of the important things it did was to help build coalitions across class lines, to some degree across race lines, not as effectively as it might have, across geographical lines, to develop a sense of the poor not as those people, but as one of us, as people whose fates and prospects are very much tied to our own. And I think that's increasingly difficult in North Carolina. As I teach my classes, I'm struck again and again, I think we're all more or less the same age sitting around this table, that ours may be the last generation of North Carolinians who in some way knew poverty firsthand. You may have grown up, as I did, in a comfortable middle-class RTP household, but you knew poverty somewhere in the family. Poverty had a human face. I think increasingly, and particularly in this divided North Carolina, that's not true. Probably more so than ever for many North Carolinians, their fellow North Carolinians who are poor are those people. And that's also something we really need to pay a lot of attention to.
I wonder if it's the case more now, or has it always been this way, that neighborhoods are divided on economic. We've gotten perhaps past some of the segregation in the past, racial segregation in neighborhoods, but basically where you live, you tend to live with people in a similar economic strata.
And some of that, of course,
is more the case now.
Well, I think more the case now because we're so much more an urban state. Again, in my classes, when I'm talking with students about this, it's always the rural students who get it and get it first. Because, again, they may come from relatively comfortable households, but the fact of the matter is that people who don't have those resources are close by, and they know them. I think if you grow up today in suburban Raleigh or Greensboro, Charlotte, poor folks, for the most part, are those folks who live over on the other side of town in the neighborhoods you're encouraged not to visit.
Mm-hmm. But if you live in a small town, you probably are more exposed to that, you think? A small rural town?
Maybe that's somewhere in the middle. I'm not sure.
But okay.
those communities are certainly divided.
But
as
I think
well.
It's true. In the last census, North Carolina really tipped from being one of, if not the most, the state with the largest rural population to being primarily now we are an urban or almost suburban state. And with that, the kind of daily contact, I think, does recede. So the problems of poverty in North Carolina really, I would say, are in our the few inner cities that we have. And in remote rural areas that are disconnected from the global economy in some fundamental way. And that's, in some ways, the same two-part challenge we had 40 years ago. I happen to live in Durham, and 5 miles from RTP in southeast central Durham, you have people living economically an early 20th century existence, young people who have no sense and no connection and no preparation for the 21st century knowledge economy that is a short bus ride away. Our challenge is how to bridge the 19th century with 21st century opportunity so that everybody has a chance to benefit from the legacy of those investments made 40 years ago. And that's I think, our deep social problem. As Jim said, how to have privileged people recognize that we're all in the same boat with others.
We go to Elsie in Pittsburgh. Hi there, Elsie. Thanks for holding on the line for us.
Oh, you're welcome.
Did you have a question for our guests or a comment?
Well, I just wanted to say that when in the day and time when I worked at the North Carolina Fund, one of the many people who worked there made the comment that there were so many ideas just coming out of the woodwork almost, but actually coming from people's mouths, that they'd thrown more ideas that were good ideas into the waste paper basket than most organizations had in a lifetime.
Was there a particularly good idea that you thought worked or should have been adopted?
No. You know, I kind of went and stayed a long time, and I ended up, I was still there and actually became part of MDC before I went on to other things.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a very integrated organization, and I say that really, black, white, young, old, women, a lot of women with jobs that were very, very unique for this area. There were not women holding down what I consider to be really professional jobs in many places, except at the North Carolina Fund.
That may be an overlooked aspect of it, because Shirley Hise mentioned that just a moment ago, too, out
yeah,
in Mitchell
yeah,
County.
Yeah, it was truly the case. And when I at one point, I was doing VISTA training, and it wasn't until, you know, actually, you know, I the other integration part of it is, of course, there were also a lot of people from other places. I'd moved here from New Jersey, so I can well tell you that it's a pretty big jump from New Jersey to working with a program that's spread out all over the state of North Carolina.
Did anybody ever call you an outside agitator?
No, not to my face. But I could easily imagine that at the staff when I was working for Mobility, they used to laughingly call the people who worked at the headquarters office in Durham as we were the house niggers, and everybody else who worked out there, including, I think, Tim Basemore, who was on your program yesterday, we were the field people. We did the real work.
David Dodson, you're nodding your head.
I've heard tell of that, yes.
Yeah, it was said. I wouldn't have said it, but it was said, and it was said, you know, in not in real derogatory terms, just as a perfectly, we're making this comment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting, because a lot of the people who came to that program had summer experiences working with migrant workers and other things, and I didn't even know what a migrant worker was, and all of a sudden I found myself faced with doing a VISTA training program for people who are going to work with programs in the migrant stream.
Mm-hmm. Jim Lalutis?
Yeah, Elsie's on to two wonderful points here. Again, it is, and it's part of the history that's overlooked, the importance of the North Carolina Fund in creating leadership opportunities for women. I think I would also emphasize this notion that she offered us, that it was an incubator for ideas, and that was by design. It was meant to be a laboratory. And you mentioned the kind of political resistance that Sanford was getting late in his political career earlier. There's a way in which the North Carolina Fund is designed to insulate it somewhat politically. It's a non-governmental organization. You say North Carolina Fund, it sounds like it's official. But it was independent in its funding and in its structure. It wasn't answerable to the state legislature. That's largely by design. It created a kind of free space in an otherwise very difficult political terrain to generate ideas.
But we should say in the closing seconds here that there was money available to continue that. The Ford Foundation, was it not offering more grants to continue the North Carolina Fund? But after 5 years, the state chose not to exercise
it,
that.
It was closed, and that's kind of a complicated issue.
Oh, okay.
But I think if I can, North Carolina philanthropy has continued to support these things, and that's one reason we're still lucky today.
Okay. We'd like to thank you both for joining us. Jim Lalutis is a history professor at UNC Chapel Hill, and David Dodson is president of MDC, Inc., which is one of the remaining organizations from the North Carolina Fund. Thank you so much. Support for North Carolina Voices Understanding Poverty comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation, the Center for Documentary Studies at Duke University, Doug and Peggy Abrams, the Julian Price Family Foundation, Maupin Taylor, PA, the Michael and Laura Brader Arahe Foundation, and the North Carolina Humanities Council. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. If you have a comment about the program, our email address is sot@wunc.org. Thanks for listening. I'm Melinda Pencava.